34 minutes after 2 o'clock, and it is an absolute delight to welcome our next guest back to Excursions. She is an award-winning. Why is that so hard for me to say twice?
Award-winning. You have to kind of slow down, right?
Award-winning filmmaker, and the latest offering from her mind, her documentarian awesomeness is American Factory. We've had an opportunity to see that screened here across the Miami Valley, having won the directing award for this from the U.S. Documentary at Sundance this year. And last year, our guest, having received the 2018 Career Achievement Award from the International Documentary Association, and now on the cusp of the opening at the Wexner Center. Tomorrow night, is that right?
Tomorrow night. I can't wait.
Julia Reichert, 50 years in film. Welcome and thank you for coming today.
Well, thank you, Nikki. Always great to be here.
You must feel right at home.
Yes.
You came to us. You're not originally from this area, but you came to Antioch College, and I believe you graduated in 1970.
Right.
And the very next year, you made a film that really sort of changed the face of our understanding of feminism in the United States and the feminist movement. That was called Growing Up Female, released back in 1971. People still make reference to this film. But before that, your very first media expression was on WYSO.
It was. It was right here. Of course, the studio looked really, really different back then. It was not at all the same studio. It was way, like, one-tenth the size. And, of course, the walls were covered with egg crates. I mean, this
actual
egg crates, which absorb sound apparently really well and are very inexpensive. So, yeah, I was on the air, and I had shows, and I learned the wonderful thing about WYSO back then, and it was pretty much a student station. The students kind of took it over, you know, as students did back then in the late 60s. But that's where I learned how to interview, how to cut tape, how to edit, how to mix music, how to tell a story, how to tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. You know, and all of this could be learned here at WYSO for no money.
Right.
It isn't like you had to have film stock and expensive cameras and fancy tape recorders or any of that. You could just do it. And I actually really loved cutting tape back then. Have you ever done that?
You know, I started in 1990 and cutting tape was done.
It was already done. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But I've seen the reel-to-reels with that little thing at the bottom. You pull it down and it's got the 45-degree angle and a razor blade nearby. That's
right.
How you edited.
That's exactly
crazy.
Right. And you hung up the little strips of tape, right? And then put them together in the order you felt was best. Yeah, that was, yeah, that's how I started. We did that for many years. Anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful time to be at WYSO back then.
A lot of notable folk.
And that was the beginning, yeah. And I used all those sound skills when we made Growing Up Female, because actually, we had so little film footage because it was so expensive to buy film stock back then from Kodak. Very, very expensive. So we really had what is called a 2-to-1 ratio, right? Which is a tiny little ratio. In other words, most of what we shot is actually in the film.
So for every 2 hours you got 1 hour of
finished
film.
So that means a lot of sound
and the
editing.
Film's 52 minutes.
52 minutes, yeah. So we shot about 100 minutes of film. And so that's why a lot of it, if people see it again, a lot of it is voiceover from documentary audio. So those skills that Jim Klein and I developed at WYSO, Jim Klein being my partner on that film, you know, came in extremely handy when we were making a very low budget film back then, Growing Up Female. And that was actually my senior project.
Wow.
That was my senior project. So if any students listening out there, you could make a film for your senior project. We did. We didn't even know how to do it. We just kind of figured it out, Antiochian style.
Oh, how lucky.
Yeah.
So you were born and raised in New Jersey.
Yep.
came here to go to college, ended up with your senior project being sort of like your trampoline jump into a career that now 50 years later, we have occasion to look back on in a retrospective. This got underway, an entity called Chicken and Egg, and they through the Wexner Center, who contacted the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, and all together this became culminated. They just finished do you call this an exhibit, or is this a will these films be playing? Can you go sit and watch these films?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's cool.
They'll be and they have a beautiful theater there at the Wexner Center, and the ticket price is not very much. I forget what it is, but it's way less than a mall theater. So tomorrow night is the first night of the retrospective. That is, what's today?
Tuesday the 1st of October.
Right, so it'll be tomorrow night. And I'm going to be doing a filmmaker talk from 5 to 6, which I'm still working on. and it has quite a few pictures from WYSO back in those days.
Also
has pictures of the kind of equipment we used back then for the camera equipment, the sound equipment, which is huge and bulky and so forth. So it has that. And it kind of walks through all the films. So that'll be, and tomorrow night after that, there's like a reception with food and all that at 6 to 7. And then at 7 starts American Factory, which is the newest film that Steve Bognar and I made. And it premiered, as you said, at Sundance this year and has been traveling the world ever since.
Wow.
Actually, it's an interesting fact that that film is now on Netflix. Right?
Right.
And Netflix is not in mainland China. It's not there. Okay? But guess what? It's a runaway hit in China. All pirated copies.
How do you... Oh, isn't that amazing? And of course, for those who haven't seen it, it's American Factory. It's about the Fuyao plant here in Dayton that and the cultural juxtaposition and outcome of this amazing... I don't know. What do we call it?
It was a huge endeavor to create a huge glass plant in an old abandoned General Motors factory.
About which you had done another film.
We had done another film, which is also in the retrospect. All the films that I've made.
10 of them, beginning in 1971.
I think something like 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 10 films are in the retrospective. The first four are on 16 millimeter, which, of course, people don't use anymore.
Right.
Were made right around here with my partner, Jim Klein. And the next, I guess, four or five were made on digital. By then, we had jumped into the digital age.
Mm-hmm.
Were made on digital. And they were also, a lot of them, made around here with my partner, Steve Bognar. So all these films are going to be seen at the Wexner Center throughout October. And I don't have all the exact dates in front of me, but each of them is followed by some kind of discussion, often with me or me and Steve or me and Jim. And at the Wexner Center, what is their website? It's something like
wexarts.org. W-E-X as in Wexner, wexarts.org.
Yeah, that's where people can find out. So tomorrow night is American Factory with a discussion with me and Steve. And then the next night is a film I'm very proud of called Seeing Red, Stories of American Communists. And that's from 1983. Right. And that's with Jim Klein, and I will be there to talk about that. But all the films are being shown. And that's the exciting thing to me is having the retrospective.
Yeah.
It's nice to get honored as a person, but what's really wonderful is that the films are getting rediscovered. Right. This is traveling all across the country. The Museum of Modern Art was the first step. Now it's the Wexner Center, but then it's going to
over the place. Wisconsin, Cleveland Institute of Art, Portland, Oregon, Louisville, Kentucky, Minneapolis, Houston, Silver Spring, Maryland, and finally ending this coming May and June at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. So
yeah.
A year's worth.
A year's worth. And actually UCLA, Los Angeles also.
Oh.
That might have been added after that was written. But anyway, it's pretty amazing to sit with an audience seeing a film like Seeing Red or Union Maids, which is even earlier, people who were not even around when the films were made, and seeing people just be captivated and have so many questions. To have those films rediscovered is really what's exciting about the retrospective. They do give, you know, they're slices of American history. They're slices of a time, and they're true slices of a time. They're, you know, we take a long time to make our films. Right? Mm. It takes a long time to find the truth sometimes. Truth takes time. And sometimes we invest 6, 7, 8 years in a film to really get it right, to really know we're telling the true story. So these are really like slices of our culture over time. Like one I would mention, because it was totally made in Dayton, is called Methadone, An American Way of Dealing. So we're now having a big crisis with heroin.
Deja vu.
Yeah. And this was the big crisis that we had in the 70s. It was a very different kind of audience, population that was affected then. And the methods of trying to cope with that were very different. And we spent months in this methadone clinic before we even brought a camera in.
Wow.
You know, like getting to know people. You know, we were entering into a different culture, me and Jim. You know, we were kids a couple of years out of college, Antioch College. But we decided to make this film, and we would just drive there and hang out and get to know people. In the last month, we brought in our camera person, who was also an Antioch student, actually Alicia Weber. She was really good. So that gives you an insight into, like, who were affected in that earlier heroin epidemic, even that there was an earlier epidemic of heroin in Dayton and all over the country.
And I found out this last round, per capita, the highest in the country. Again, it's like the worst kind of deja vu.
I know. Dayton has been always very hard hit.
Yeah.
I think it's because we're largely like working class town. Mm. Or we certainly were, and now we're almost like an ex-working class town, which has sent a lot of people to, you know, get painkillers and so on.
I love that you say we. Methadone was out in 1974. By the time Union Maids was released in 1976, it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. So your third film out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think of that and how this Julia Reichert, 50 years in film, will travel across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I marvel at that you stay in Dayton, that you could go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You're not even from here, but you, since you came here, have made this your home. Why do you stay in Dayton?
Well, you know, I really like Dayton. I mean, it's home. I mean, now I live in Yellow Springs. I lived in Dayton for a long time, and I love Yellow Springs, and I love Dayton. Well, there's probably a few reasons. One is I like living among regular people. You know, if I lived in New York or L.A. or San Francisco, my friends who I hung out with would be other filmmakers, people in the arts, let's say. The people I went to dinner with and hung out with or whatever. And there's some of that here.
Sure.
But overall, you know, like my one neighbor is a high school teacher. Another neighbor works at the post office. You know, another neighbor is a contractor. Just regular folks. And when we want to have screenings of our films as works in progress, which we do a lot, I might have even invited you, Nikki, to one or more of them. It's just, you know, you get feedback from not other filmmakers and not other big city people, but regular folks who we want to be our audience. That's one thing. Another thing is, in order to be an independent filmmaker, in other words, to really pursue the stories that you feel are most important, right? Not to look around, not to think, what kind of movie can I get funded? Right? Like look for money to make a film or look to, what should my next film be? What would be a hit? See, me and Jim and me and Steve have never, ever thought that way. We look to see what would be a story that would make sense for us to tell and that seemed important. And whenever we get started, we use our own resources. Like we have a camera, We have sound equipment. We have a car.
Yeah.
You know? So we're like citizens with cameras now. So our living, so we can go and we and pursue the story of the closing of the General Motors plant, or pursue the story of children fighting cancer at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. You know, we can do that without funding, which allows you a tremendous amount of freedom to be independent, to not be doing something for a big company like Netflix or HBO or one of the many companies out there. So life in this area is not expensive, right? We don't have, we own our house. We own our cars. Mm-hmm. We've been able to pay them off. We have a nice sized house. We have a yard. We have a garden.
Just last week, you brought us some peppers and thank
That's
you.
That's right. Yeah. I had too many peppers this year. I still have too many. I should bring some
I'll
more
I'll stop
over.
By on the way out.
So that's another reason I love living here. Just the people around and the fact that you can live inexpensively and have the freedom to do what you think is important to do. I think those are, you know, those are two big reasons anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, there need to be more voices in film from the Midwest. You know, let's face it, most filmmakers are on the coast.
Yep.
Pretty much. So we've sort of looked to as like, oh,
I remember hearing the term flyover states.
The flyover state.
I'd never heard it before at that moment, but I recognized exactly what it was. I thought, really? Is that what we are? Flyover state?
Yeah, people don't know the difference still between Iowa and Ohio.
I still
get that. And Idaho.
Just too many vowels.
Yeah.
We're in studio with Julia Reichert. Julia Reichert, 50 years in film, this exhibition, having just come closed at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, comes to the Wexner Center in Columbus, Ohio, with an opening tomorrow night. Julia gives a speech, did you say, from 5 to 6, roughly?
Or? 5 to 6.
5 to
yeah.
6.
And then there's a party.
And then a party.
With food and drink.
And then a film.
And then the film, American Factory, which I'm, you know, very proud of. It's been a kind of a hit, actually.
Yeah.
It's been amazing.
I love that it's popular across China. I love it.
I know, across China.
Do you know, do they dub it then? Or is English is probably perhaps prevalent enough that, I mean, I wonder if someone, the bootleggers, bothered to dub it.
Well, you know, it's actually available on Netflix in 29 languages, including Chinese, because they do have Hong Kong and Taiwan. It is in Chinese. So I'm thinking that what I don't know for sure, but I'm thinking what all those millions and millions of Chinese people saw on their cell phones probably when they watched the film was with Chinese subtitles. And there's been, I forget how many millions of like social media, people talking about the film, people going back and forth. And one of the really cool things, there was an article in The Economist that quoted some of the social media statements that were made in China.
And about the movie.
About the movie. And several of them said things like, you know, this movie reminds us that the wonderful success of China economically is built on the backs of workers' exploitation. Because in the film, you see that in China, it's very common that people work 12-hour days, 6 days a week, even 7 days a week. You see that in the film when we talk to Chinese workers in a factory there. The factory is very efficient. It puts out great glass really fast. They don't have as much automation as we do, partly because people work so fast and so efficiently and don't talk that much.
Wow.
They just keep going. It's a different culture. I mean, it's not our culture. The expectations of some of the Chinese supervisors and managers for work output and work life by American blue-collar workers, those expectations did not go over well, right? Sometimes people would be told, you can't take lunch, you know. You have to work.
Which goes back to union maids, the whole notion of, you know, gathering together to be a more a stronger unit, which just doesn't, I guess, exist at all.
Not in the same way. Everyone in China is in a union, but it's not the same concept as we have. I mean, the union movement, which is part of the government, does tend to speak up for workers. But here we really have a tradition of a stronger collective voice for working people via unions. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will say it is getting smaller and smaller, the union movement. Although actually, you know, I've been reading a lot about labor because the labor movement has really embraced American Factory, like the AFL-CIO and the UAW and so forth. There have been more strikes, like more work stoppages by workers, whether they're teachers or other high-tech workers in the past year than there have been in many years. So there's a feeling that people are, you know, at the same time, I was just reading this in McPaper the other day at a hotel. Income inequality is the highest it's been in, I forget how many decades, like right now. Income inequality. And the lack of unions probably has something to do with that. And you'll see in American Factory, you'll see how the company was taught by the Americans how to fight a union organizing effort at that Fuyao plant. And it's something that most people don't realize, is that there's specific companies that are out there to specifically whose purpose is to defeat unions. Union avoidance consultants. And most people just don't know about it. And some of the things...
Union avoidance consultants, UAC?
That's a general term. The one in our film was called Labor Relations Institute. So it's kind of neutrally about labor relations.
Right.
But, you know, it's sole purpose. If you ever were to go on their website, you'd see that they are a union avoidance company. Anyway, that's... So we have union maids where we see the kind of the birth of unions, right? That the energetic birth of unions in the 30s and 40s. And then we see the last truck. And then we see American Factory, where you see the defeat of the union movement in this
country.
What
an arc you've documented.
It's amazing. I was thinking of it the other day, Nikki. I have a film. The films, the historic films, which are three, actually four now with the new one, 9 to 5. It's about the 9 to 5 movement of clerical workers in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Every decade of the 20th century and now the 21st century is touched upon in one of the films.
Wow.
It's like that was not a plan.
Yeah.
It was not a plan, but it kind of turned out that way.
Well, it makes sense. And you talk about the next subject. It makes sense that you're here, that you stay here, because you can just exist in your community, a very genuine sort of grassroots feel, and just like what's happening here, what's important, and and by virtue of that, this arc, it's just remarkable. It's Julia Reichert, 50 years in film, an exhibition that begins its presence at the Wexner Center in Columbus. You can find out more, and I hope you will, at wexarts.org, all one word, wexarts.org. The American Factory is available on Netflix, but available tomorrow night in Columbus with a special talk.
See it on the big screen.
The big screen.
Which is always, of course, much better. And let's not forget, once again, I know it's almost three, but it all started at WYSO. For me, it all started at WYSO. With me as a kid, you know, college student, learning how to edit, learning how to interview, you know, developing those powers as just a young person.
And it's really funny that this should happen on this day. I love serendipity just in general. We have a house full of students, young radio storytellers from Ponant Center today. They're teenagers, and they're going to be a part of that next generation, that next wave. And you're just a perfect, perfect person to look to and say, do you want to do something?
Because you could do it.
You could do
it. You can find a way. You can find a way to do it. That's what we did at the sort of the Antioch way, the WYSO way, is, you know, you do it by hook or crook. You just figure it out. We figured out everything, how to make a poster, how to edit, how to do a sound mix, you know, for a film. Jim and I did our first one. Just ourselves. We didn't realize there were professionals in New York City
that would
do that. What they do. The next films, we, of course, did have a sound mix. And one of them was by an old WYSO person, Randy Tom.
who went on to work with, yeah, on the Star Wars, among other things.
Yeah.
I mean, think of that.
I know. Randy Tom from WYSO.
Yeah.
He's a legend in the sound world now. Wherever you go, Randy Tom is like, people are awed by him. And he started here. He's now the top guy at Skywalker Sound.
Yeah.
He has, I don't know how many Oscars.
Yeah.
Several.
Aww.
And he keeps a picture on his desk of himself at WYSO.
Does he?
Yep, he does. A little black and white picture.
It's like
not
where it started.
Right on his desk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the winner of many Academy Awards. You've been nominated multiple times. And I wonder, this time around, what we'll see.
Who knows?
Who knows? Julia Reichert, 50 years in film. Thank you so much for taking the time and talking with
us
today.
Thank you, Nikki. This is fun.
Isn't it? And if you would like to see Julia talk about this amazing film, American Factory, you'll make your way to Columbus tomorrow for the opening of this exhibit, a fabulous booklet they put together, Julia. So
you
nice.
You get a copy of it. And it's playing all over the country after that, all around. So tell your friends and neighbors.
Julia Reichert, 50 years in film. It's been an honor. Thank you so much, Julia.
Okay.
This is 91.3 WYSO Yellow Springs. We broadcast from the campus of Antioch College. We're listener-supported and community-owned, serving Southwest Ohio.
New insights into the 1975 disappearance of the mob-connected labor leader Jimmy Hoffa, who's portrayed by Al Pacino in Scorsese's new film, The Irishman. We talk with Jack Goldsmith, whose stepfather, Chuck O'Brien, spent decades at Hoffa's side, willing to do anything for his boss, like intimidate nosy journalists.
He purchased a head of a cadaver, put it in a box, wrapped up the box, and sent it to Martin Hayden, who was the editor of the Detroit News.
When Hoffa disappeared, a